You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey folks, this is Ken Corsini with The Deal Farm. On today's Best Deal Ever episode, I am joined by Frank Cava out of Richmond, Virginia. Frank is a fellow member of the Collective Genius and has an extensive background in managing new home construction, actually having managed over 2,000 houses. He then went on to start his own rehab and wholesaling business where he's crushing it in multiple markets in Virginia, doing over 100 houses a year, and actually has a rental portfolio of about 40 houses. I'm super stoked to have him on the show. So, Frank, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ken. Appreciate it. Let's do it.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate you coming on. So, you know, you and I have known each other for a while. We're both in Collective Genius, but I don't really know your backstory. I mean, I know that you had worked new construction for a number of years. Maybe take us back. How did you get into real estate initially?
So, I did it the way that a lot of people get into the construction business, which is my grandfather and my dad were both in construction. Oh. And when I was a little kid, I used to go with them because lunch was really fun when you work in construction. So I go like hunt for frogs and, you know, have lunch with them. And, you know, but I kind of like as I got a little bit older, it graduated from lunch to run into the car and then, you know, actually doing stuff. And I kind of fell in love with the construction business.
Interesting.
And that was my first introduction.
Interesting. Do they have their own businesses or they worked for large construction companies? What did that look like?
No, they're both real small kind of operators. But yeah, they like my dad is in his 60s and he still goes to work and sweats every day. Like he does the physical stuff.
Wow. So you were hands on right out of the gates. Then did you end up going to school for that or what did that look like?
So when I was graduating high school, my brother and I talked to our dad and we're like, all right, well, we're going to just come work for you when we graduate high school. He goes, oh, no, you're going to college. So I was in a pretty cool spot like senior year in college senior year in high school where I was talking to this lady whose husband went to University of Florida. And it just so happens she told me about a major called Building Construction Management. So I had never heard of it and I thought I wanted to be a doctor. So I go to school and I start taking chemistry. I'm like, this sucks. So I pivoted while I was in school and I changed my major to construction management, which is kind of a cross between civil engineering and architecture.
Where'd you go to school?
University of Florida.
University of Florida? Come on, man. I'm a bulldog. Yeah, you're a Gator?
I am. You guys have owned us the last couple of years in football.
Not really. No, man. We'll have a good season, and then we'll play at the end of the season, and you guys will have a crappy season and still somehow beat us, which has been so frustrating. If you look over the last 20 years, you guys have definitely owned us. I had no idea you were a Gator, man. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, we can't be friends, just so you know.
Fair enough. Let's get through this,
man. This interview's over, man. I'm sorry. That's funny. So you were a construction management major and came out of Florida, and then where'd you go?
So there's small classes that actually graduate. They do kind of like on a half a year kind of a thing is how they break them down. So in my class, I was one of two people that went into residential. And the reason I didn't go commercial construction is I worked as an intern in commercial construction. I kind of realized like that life is kind of a meat grinder.
Yeah.
And I remember like literally walking around with someone on a Saturday afternoon and it was like somewhere between like 5 and 6 at night. And he took me to their office, commercial construction office, South Florida. I walked around and there was like 50 desks and like 20 of them were full. So I remember thinking to myself, well, 20 people out of this entire office are working on a Saturday. I got to work Sundays if I want to get ahead. So, and I didn't want to do that. So I went up to Northern Virginia and I interviewed with a home building company that is one of the largest in the U.S. And what I really liked is that they were going to teach me the home building side and then they were going to teach me the sales side. And I went up there and they talked about life balance and all this other stuff. I'm like, well, hell, I can work Saturdays and I can get way ahead of these people. Plus they hire a lot of English majors and I was a construction major. I'm going to like fly up the ranks. So it was a very strategic move for me. And the other thing I learned is that most people like shy of Bill Gates, you know, or Zuckerberg nowadays have some real estate holdings that drive wealth. And I was like, well, if I can learn how to build houses, I can learn how to build my own house. I can learn how to build a portfolio of houses. So that was kind of what started the process of me, you know, being into the whole housing thing.
Man, that's pretty insightful for a college kid fresh out of school. Most college kids don't know how to put their pants on straight.
However that thought process happened for me, I look at it as something I got real fortunate with, because I mean, that was the problem. I remember going home and telling my mom, because we lived in South Florida, I'm like, everybody was working. I don't want to go work there.
So you're originally from Florida and then ended up in Virginia. You've been there ever since.
That's right. I moved here right out of college.
Interesting. So what was, so who did you work for? And did you stay with them for a while?
I did. I worked for a publicly traded home builder. They're huge. They dominate the DC metro market. And what I did was, I was kind of alluding to, I started with, you know, in the field. Like, literally, I had to check my ego. Like, I had to unload trim trucks, push a broom, do like just menial tasks. And, you know, 3 months of that kind of graduated to, you know, it was kind of like the whole thing with my dad. I used to go just for lunch, but eventually I was able to do some fun stuff that was actually, you know, contributing. My career started the same way. I started off really low. I checked my ego. I worked real hard. I proved value. And then within 5 years of graduating high school or college, excuse me, I was promoted to it was about 5 years I was promoted to vice president. I just turned 30.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was kind of like get in there and just plug really hard and prove that you're valuable and learn the system. And yeah, I guess it was a little, maybe 6 years, a little over six, but I was just 30 years old when I got promoted to vice president. And then in my last 4 years working there, I ran profit centers in Northern Virginia. And if you've been paying attention to the home building cycle, you know, early 90s through 19 through 2006, it was like straight up. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, like a roller coaster, you usually get straight up and then the payoff is the straight down. In the home building sector, when it kind of went sideways, we had 75 employees that I managed. We did almost $200 million a year in sales, and my staff was just eradicated. We went from 75 to 23. We went from $200 million to 80, and I was not having any fun. I was able to save some money along the way, and I just looked at myself and I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. So I just said, screw it. And I was like, if I can figure out a way to make money in this business in real estate now, I can survive any market. So I just got out and started my own thing.
What year was that? Was that like six, seven, somewhere in there at the downturn?
The downturn really hit us up in Virginia around, we felt it like six, seven, eight. Uh-huh. I actually quit my job in January of 2009.
2009. You're like, forget this.
Yep.
And so you left home building, and then how did you figure out what you were going to do next?
So I had a non-compete with my old job, so I couldn't like just go down the street and build a house, because that would have been in direct competition. Mm-hmm. So I had to think about, okay, similar to what I did out of college. All right, I know what my strengths are. I know what my weaknesses are. I know what I can't do because of my non-compete. Why don't I find a business where I can use my strengths, it doesn't infringe upon my non-compete, and it gives me some real advantage? So what I looked at the time, it was like short sales, and there was people flipping, but there were very few of them, and it was not nearly as popular as it is now. But I looked at it, and I'm like, okay, if I want to preserve the bucket of cash that I have, I want to buy a house, and I want to get in and out of it and make some money, the market only drops so far in 3 to 6 months. It really does. Even in the worst markets, it still doesn't go straight down. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, if I buy a house, I fix it, I flip it, I'm in and out, and I can make some money, then I think that's a pretty good deal. And the upside of that is I'm going to be, if I buy it right, I'm going to preserve at least getting my money back. So I did my first deal. I was in and out in less than 6 months. I made around 30 grand, but I did everything myself. I like literally moved furniture out of my house and staged with it. Like it was like, you know, that kind of a story.
I mean, the fact that you flipped in 2009 though and had a retail buyer and made money. I mean, it's funny because so many people are losing their shirts then. The fact that you were able to right out of the gates be successful. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
So I did that. Thank you. I did that one, which was cool. And then I was like, all right, this is kind of fun. And then I got serious and I did a house that I made like 65 grand on, but it was literally like ripped the whole thing apart. But what I started to learn, and as I was honing my skills, was that if you find a market where someone wants to buy and you provide a product that is better than what people expect for the money, it's going to sell no matter the market. And that's kind of the mantra we live on even now. Now, we do high-end stuff. I mean, we've done $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 flips. But the majority of what we do is in the first-time home buyer, second-time move-up, second time discretionary. So if that's Greek to you, what that means is under 275 grand, usually they bought one house, but it's more shelter than showpiece. And so in some places that where we work, we'll go real low end. We'll do vinyl floors. We'll do, you know, the not the nicest finishes. But then on the higher end stuff, we really kind of study what the market wants and we give them that. But even at a $150,000 house, you can be better than everybody else. You don't have to have the highest end stuff. You just need to be better than what people expect for the money. And mm-hmm. they'll pick you if it's priced right.
You know, it's funny. My wife and I have this exact same conversation daily now, because now she's a little bit more involved in the business with the filming. But it's all about your price point. You know, if you're selling a house, exactly like you said, $150,000, it's like you don't have to go over the top with the best tile and the best hardwoods. It's like they don't care. At some point, they don't know the difference between laminates and hardwoods. So why spend the money? They don't expect it.
That's right.
You're really just throwing away money at that point.
The other thing, I'm sure you've noticed this in your market, Ken. I've noticed it here. There's a lot of people that run this like a hobby and they don't run it like a real business.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people build for ego and they build for pictures.
Yep.
And what it is like there's people in my market, they're like, well, you don't rip it down to the studs. And they say it to me like, you know, I'm a criminal because I don't. But if it doesn't need to, you're damn right I'm not going to. Because like my goal is not to do the same thing every time and quickly find myself being a dinosaur. I want to have the flexibility of doing what the house needs so it sells and the market appreciates it. Mm-hmm. And so to that end, it's if you're listening to this and you're trying to say, how do I apply what these guys are talking about into my business? What it is find a product, build it the right way for the market, fix it so people in that market will appreciate it and be better than almost everybody in your pricing sector, and you're going to sell and you're going to make money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think you're spot on. You don't fix a house to make it the prettiest house. You fix a house to make money at the end of the day. And how do you make money? You make money by, like you said, doing a good job, but just enough to be nicer than your neighbor and to sell quickly, but not over the top.
Like, we're not a Rolls Royce and we're not a Mercedes. We're probably somewhere between a really nice BMW and, you know, in the working class neighborhoods, we're more of a working class kind of a car. Yeah. Like that's where we are.
You're like a 3 Series.
Yeah.
There you go.
Maybe we'll push 5, but I'm not the 7 Series or the SLK.
That's right. That's good. So this was 2009. You started flipping. You're in there kind of doing it yourself. And now, fast forward, I mean, 2016, over 7 years, what is your what sort of iterations has your business gone through?
Tons. So I told you earlier in kind of the lead up to me starting my own business is I was an executive. And I literally will never forget this day as long as I live. I woke up at like 4 o'clock in the morning. I got to work really early. I fired 20-something people in one day.
Really?
So crushing. I mean, thankfully, I kept my job. But like I had to fire a ton of people. And when I started my business, I didn't want to do that. So I grew very, very methodically and very slow and very carefully. So people always ask, how do you grow? How do you hire? How do you do that? So at first I did everything. And then I quickly learned the things that I stunk at because I was usually needing to do those at like 10 at night. So I was like, okay, here's the 3 or 4 things that are on my list that I'm not good at. Most of them had to do with books, accounting, that kind of stuff. It's just not my strength. I don't mind it, but it's not my strength.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to my accountant. I found a bookkeeper, brought her in part-time, and then that position eventually grew to a full-time kind of a person. Then I brought in someone to help me analyze deals and meet with other people. So I slowly kind of grew it. 2009, I did a bunch of short sales, a couple of flips. I did very few wholesales, and you know, I was doing it by myself. Now I have a staff of just about 10 people. I just hired a gentleman yesterday who's going to run my construction operation. I've gotten into the education business. My business is a lot different. Like this year we'll do right around 100 total transactions. We do fix and flips. We do wholesales. We own a portfolio of rentals. And our market is still ripe to grow the rental portfolio. So I've kind of put a lasso around a handful of communities. And the reason I brought this new person in is I'm going to start aggressively buying rentals. Interest rates are really low. Pricing is right. There's opportunity for it. So we're going to start – my goal is to start adding about 30 rentals a year to our portfolio.
Wow. And what's your portfolio at right now?
Right around 40.
Right around 40. It's what do you guys? I'm just curious because you know, from we've got a small portfolio, and I've had portfolios, and I've sold portfolios of homes, and they can be such a distraction from your core business. What are you doing to manage those right now? What does that look like going forward?
So what we do in every step of our business is kind of the hiring mentality that I just used of how I found my accountant and the list of things to do. Everyone in my office has a task list of 3 to 5 items. So they do 3 to 5 things. And I don't mean like per day they like check 3 emails. I mean they have like 3 to 5 core competencies. So my office manager, she oversees our books. She oversees our rental portfolio. But we have a management company that actually physically handles the day-to-day. They find the tenants. They deal with any of the delinquencies with rent. They deal with the repairs. And then Denise, my office manager, yesterday was bill paying day. We do it on the 10th and the 25th. She runs me a full report. The top of the rental report, what I look at is what's vacant, what are our problems, what kind of repairs are we dealing with. So then I get to just manage the paperwork and manage each piece. And if there's something I don't like, I'll prioritize going to see it or having a meeting. But I outsource a lot of that stuff to smart people.
Yeah, you have to, because rentals can become a huge drain if you don't have the right people in place to manage that for you. As you being in Northern Virginia, are there pretty? I'm assuming there's some pretty awesome rental opportunities up there.
There are. I mean, I know you have gone into other markets because the returns are great. Our returns are solid. Like we're not an A plus or a home run kind of a return, if you want to use the baseball analogy. Mm-hmm. But we're a good. We can make singles and doubles all day long in our rentals.
Yeah, but you're also, we haven't really talked about, but I mean, Virginia's a real steady market, right? I mean, you're not seeing any big fluctuations up or down.
That's right. And I used to live in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is a college town, and I moved to Richmond. One of the reasons I moved to Richmond is because the business opportunities here are better. And I'm going to give you an example. I owned 8 townhouses. It was roughly $2 million worth of real estate. And of those units, they would bring in about $1,250 a month. So, you know, it was like 10 grand. And I looked at my 2 million and I'm making 10 grand. I'm like, that's not that great. So then I looked at it Richmond and I'm like, all right, I can take that same 2 million and I can make like almost 40. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit more of a headache and there's a little bit more of a hassle involved, but the return is so much stronger. So kind of how I analyzed my decision on where to work or how I analyze my rentals now, I looked at how my money was working for me. People are like, oh, you're crazy selling them now. I'm like, no, I can take a small loss, but then put myself in an opportunity where I have better buys that will appreciate better and will pay better returns. And that's what I've done.
Yeah. So most of your portfolio right now is in Richmond?
Yeah. I own a couple of lingerers in Charlottesville, but almost all of them are here in Richmond.
Gotcha. So, you know, so running, I mean, we actually have very similarly sized businesses. Same thing. We got about 10 people on staff. We're doing about 100 houses a year. I'm curious, what are you doing to manage that? Because it's, as you well know, there are a lot of details. What is it like? What does a week look like for you guys to operate at that volume?
Sure. So Mondays and Tuesdays are pretty hectic in our office. First thing Monday morning, the sales team and my office manager and our marketing manager meet. What they do is they do a report we call traffic. Traffic is a summary of what happened the week before. We track phone calls, we track appointments, we track deals under contract, and we track deals that physically closed. Now, it over time will produce a fantastic report card because I can see exactly what happened each week and kind of look back at it anecdotally. But as it's going on an ongoing basis, the really cool part of it is I can kind of track each piece. When something comes in on traffic for an under contract or an appointment, it makes it to – this all happens at 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. At 10:30, I meet with the marketing manager and the sales team. And this meeting can last from 90 minutes to 3 hours. And what we do is we look at each and every deal that they had an appointment on that seems to be a prospect that they had an appointment on or that is currently under contract. When it's under contract, what happens is anything under contract, we have a CRM, and then we have, you know, clearly all the technology everyone has with like Google Maps and that stuff. So we have just a really simple Word document. On the Word document, there's a thumbnail picture of the house, because when you start looking at 10, 15 houses a month, I need something that's going to trigger the address in my head. Mm-hmm. So I see that picture. Then the sales team has put together for me just a couple of links. I got the link to our CRM where I can look at all the details. I have a link to the Google Maps so I can pull it up. And then I have very specific things like purchase price, contract date, expiration date of study. And then people come in with what they think we should do with the house. Like, this is a great flip opportunity. And they'll run their comps that way, and I look at it. Or they think it's a good wholesale opportunity. And we go through and kind of look at what we do with each house. And that meeting takes forever, like 3 hours sometimes. But the upside is we have a game plan on each and every asset that comes through the door.
Man, that is super hands-on. I'm curious, what is your by sales team, you're really talking about acquisitions, right?
Correct, but I have them also do the back-end selling as well.
We'll talk about that for a second. How do you have that? What's your acquisitions and sales department structured like?
Sure. I don't know if you've ever bought a car, but I always hated when I bought a car and the salesman would sit down and go, oh, this thing's great. It's got the power locks. And then you sit there and it's got a hand crank. You're like, what are you talking about? And they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Right.
And I remember this from like being a younger man and thinking there's such a level of insincerity here. I feel like our business is ripe with people who don't know what they're doing. And I don't want my sales team to be uneducated. So I want them to physically know the owner. I want them to physically know the property. And then when they speak to the people on the sales side, I want them to know everything they need to know about that house so they can connect those dots. Hmm. And it's not the most efficient system. People that we have as common friends do it very differently. But I like the fact that there is some continuity with each property.
Mm-hmm. So there's still a handoff between acquisitions and sales. It's just a warm handoff.
No, I have the same person that acquired it sell it.
Really? Okay. So curious, how many acquisition folks do you have then?
We have two full-time.
Two full-time, and they're going on appointments. They're all external?
No, they're here. They're in the office quite a bit, but it's probably a 50-50 split between being in the office and being in the field.
Okay. So if they can close them over the phone, great, but more than likely they're setting up an appointment, meeting in person, and trying to close the deal.
We close over the phone probably 10% of the time or less.
Yeah, most of it's just getting in front of somebody. So your salesperson, your acquisition person gets out there, they land an acquisition, and then they stay involved through purchasing, and then you're fixing it, and then also through the disposition, through the selling process?
They are very involved if it's a wholesale deal. If it goes into a flip,
uh-huh.
they are out, and then that comes into my department. So if we buy things as a whole, so this is, I think this will be very beneficial for your listeners. We get a house, we analyze it. Let's just say in 2015, last year, our average wholesale deal was $13,008, and our average flip deal was just under $40,000. Those numbers are actually better into 16, but I have a full year to work with, so let's just use those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at those two numbers with a $40,000 flip and a $16,000 wholesale deal, it's about a 40% number. So what we look at is if we can get 40% of our flip value right now as a wholesale, we'll do it.
Gotcha. So that's the primary goal, is to wholesale if you can, move on. But so what's the determining factor then between buying it or just wholesaling it?
So that's it. It comes down to math. Now, if there's a house in a, like, there's certain communities where we're really good on flips. Like, we know exactly what to do. We know the buyer. We have everything dialed in. In that instance, we won't just use math. We'll use a little bit of kind of feel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a particular area here in Richmond. We own 12 houses inside of a square half mile. And the thought process there is, all right, if we pop one in there, we're probably going to flip it because we know that area and it's great for us. Other areas that aren't as well-defined or a little bit further outside, and it becomes a little bit more of a challenge to flip, we're very detailed on, do we want to actually own this? And if the answer is yes, what does the math look like? If the answer is we might want to own it, but if we can wholesale it and get this price, and our number is 40%, so if it's a $40,000 flip, if we can get at least $16,000 on a wholesale, we'll wholesale it.
Gotcha. What percentage of your business right now is wholesale versus flip?
We're about 60% wholesale, 40% flip.
Okay, no, that's a good number. And then how much? And then some percentage of that's also you just bringing in houses into like a personal portfolio.
Exactly.
Okay. Interesting. And so in terms of finding your deals right now, you got two acquisitions people, you're keeping them busy. Is it mostly direct mail? How are most of those leads being generated?
We do direct mail, and then we do online advertising as well. And with our online advertising, we do PPC, which is pay-per-click. And then we do some lead aggregators. So there's some companies out there that do a ton of PPC, collect the leads and sell them, and we buy those.
I gotcha. Is that where, how's PPC working for you? Have you done it long enough to have some pretty good metrics around it?
We have, and I feel like the analogy I use pretty often is direct mail is similar to Domino's mailing you a flyer, and PPC is a lot more like you get on your phone, you look at pizza, and then you figure out who's close, you order one, and you get a pizza. And like you don't stop until like that pizza's ordered.
Right.
So I feel like we get better deals out of the PPC game, but I feel like the conversion is lower. And on the direct mail side, it's a little bit more of a farming expedition.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you, how many are you sending out? What's, is it postcards or is it yellow letters or a little bit of everything?
Postcards, we send out over 40,000 a month. We do other forms of advertising through mail, which is probably another five.
Okay. Gotcha. And then that, and that amount keeps your two sales guys, your acquisition guys, busy on appointments and lead follow-up and whatnot.
Very much so.
Interesting. And then do you guys have any sort of extensive drip campaigns? Because as you and I both know, man, the deals are in the drip. It's all in the follow-up.
The honest answer to that is we're not as good as we need to be,
Yeah.
and we're building that out as we speak.
You have a CRM, I guess, that your sales guys are going back into and just doing follow-up calls and whatnot.
Exactly. And I'm starting to use some VAs for that as well.
Yeah, we've, you know, we've used some automated systems for drip here recently, like text blasts and voicemail blasts and emails. And it's like, you, once you set it up, it's unbelievable when those things hit. Like the phone just rings off the hook when those things, when like a voicemail blast drops or something. And we always pop deals, old deals too, that have been out there forever, just by automating some of that drip.
It's for those of you listening that don't know exactly what we're talking about. You usually send out mail. These people come in, and then if you can't convert them right away, the amateurs just kind of forget about those leads. Guys like Ken and I, what we do is we have the back office set up where we can actually physically continue to touch them and manage it. And like that Monday meeting that I was telling you about, we go back and we look at who are we touching, who are we calling, how are we doing these things, and that's what takes us, you know, from being different from everybody else in our market is the constant follow-up.
Absolutely. Yeah. When the fact that you're staying, that's the other thing. The fact that you're staying involved with your sales guys and there's accountability there, you know what they're looking at. And then you can even pick one out and say, man, I need you to follow up on that particular deal because it's one I know we really want. That accountability is huge for getting productivity out of the sales guys.
For sure.
So you've been at this a number of years. I mean, home, doing new home construction and then building this, you know, house flipping and wholesaling business. Is there any deal in particular that stands out as like your best deal ever?
So I'm gonna tell you three different flavors. I'm gonna give you kind of three different ones. The first one is one we just closed about a month ago. It came to me through a realtor. One of the best ways for us to get deals is networking with realtors, and they bring us pocket listings. So this particular deal, realtor called me up. I bought it. I think I bought it in like December or January. So by the time it closed, it was like beginning of the year. And instead of ripping the thing down to the studs, which is very popular in this area, we looked at it and said, okay, there was a 1990s renovation in here. It's had a 200 amp service. It's a pretty good house. We had had a house around the corner that we sold, and we underpriced it. We priced it at 290. We had seven offers, and we ended up selling it at 325. Once we were ratified, I asked the realtor to go back to some of the people who lost and see if they wanted to pre-purchase some of our other houses. So they pre-purchased this house from us. We did a more than a lipstick renovation, but we did not go down to the stud. And we were in and out of the house in about 5 months. It was pre-sold, so the back end was awesome. And it was really cool because it was pre-sold, so we did a lot of finishes that we wouldn't normally do. Like these, they had these old floors that were, you know, from the 18, literally from the 1830s. They're the old planks, and it looked cool as hell, but it was like, you know, you could see urine on from dogs and pets. Like if we were gonna flip it would have been neutered because we would have just gone with a dark stain.
Right.
And but because of that, it worked out well. So it worked out great for us. It worked out great for the buyers, and we ended up making like 70 grand on that deal. And we did not do full surgery. So that was a pretty cool one.
Very cool. Yeah, I love that. You know, the one thing, a question I would have is, were the, was the the buyer involved while you were rehabbing it? Did they kind of watch the process?
Yep, and we got it to a point where I didn't want to sell it until we were done with the stuff we didn't want to change.
Yeah.
Like, we had the floor plan, we had just about everything laid out, and then what we did is we sold it, and then we showed them, okay, here are your selection choices for cabinets and for granite and for tile, but the floor plan's locked in.
Yeah. That's where your home building experience came into play, because that can be really tricky to manage expectations while you're rehabbing.
It is.
So it sounds like you managed that well and turned a nice profit. That's killer. You gotta love that, man. When an agent just drops a deal in your lap in an era you know that you're gonna make money on, I mean, that's perfect.
Oh yeah, I mean, this same agent and I took him to lunch 12 months ago thereabouts, and he's brought me at least 10 deals. And he likes it because, like, we were in California together for CG, and I bought a house sitting in the room texting him.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Dude, that is. Those can be your best thinking deals, is just a relationship with a real estate agent who's a little bit connected.
Heck yeah. He knew, like, so if you're out there and you're looking like, how do I find a good realtor, help me buy stuff, right? In this particular community, this guy must have 25 signs out at any given time. So I just drove by a sign one day, I wrote down his number, I called him up, I'm like, hey, I'm Frank Hava. I see your signs everywhere. Can I buy you lunch? And he knew my name because I'm pretty active. So he's like, yeah, hell yeah, let's do it. So we went, we had lunch, and we ended up talking, and we were pretty similar in a lot of ways. And he knows that I'm not going to pay the most. So he doesn't bring me every deal. Uh-huh. But he'll bring me deals where he's like, hey, this guy needs to move fast. Can you close in 9 days? I'm like, let me look at it. Let me check title. Yeah, I'll do it. And, you know, he had another deal that we just bought the other day. We bought it for like 180, I think 185. The thing's going to sell for 350. Every other investor in the market passed. I'm going to spend 80 grand on it, and I'll make 50 to 60 grand because I'm going to do what the house needs, not what my ego tells me I should do.
Yeah, yeah. And
he was on the market. The contract fell out. He called me up. He's like, my buyer's just sick of this thing. You want to buy it? I was like, I need it at this number. He goes, okay, let me see if I can get it done, and we closed.
Dude, and that's the thing. Reputation is everything. If you can close quick and people know that you are going to honor your contracts, they just keep bringing deals back to you.
And Ken's point's a great one. I had a realtor come up to me a couple of days ago, and he goes, yeah, I heard that you were buying that house. And it was just another house, and one of my reps did it. And I literally remember the rep sitting in the office with us. He's like, I think we're going to need to cancel. I'm like, no, you're not going to cancel. We're going to figure out how to get this deal done. Like, we got to lower our price. We got to go back to the seller. We got to arm wrestle, but we're closing. And it ended up closing. And, like, I had no idea who was paying attention or what. But a couple months go by, and this agent that was on the other end of the deal calls me up. He's like, yeah, I know that you had to go wrangle with that seller a little bit and get them motivated. But I told him, like, man, you should do it. That guy's going to close. So people are paying attention even if you don't think they are.
Absolutely. Well, and there's a lot of investors that have bad names who put stuff under contract with no intention of closing, whether they're just wholesalers or what. So when you develop a reputation for somebody that performs, it makes all the stinking difference in the world.
Yeah.
That's cool. I love that. I mean, I love the pocket listings. And that happens even we have an acquisition agent who's just making offers on MLS, but now she's sort of developed a reputation with other agents because we've closed. And so she gets the pocket listings and brings them to us because other agents have seen that, hey, these guys close when they say they're going to close. They're a legitimate buyer. I mean, it's
if you want to get into this business and you don't have a lot of money for overhead, like direct mail postcards, the amount that Ken and I send out, I mean, you're talking 20 grand a month. I mean, it adds up. If you just buy someone coffee and then you do what you say you're going to do, you can do that a lot cheaper and you can find good deals. And you only need one or two in the course of a year to make something. I mean, hell, that deal I made 70 grand on, my mom was a school teacher. She used to work all year for that kind of money.
Yeah. My wife was a teacher and made a lot less than that in the course of a year and worked her butt off, probably harder than me.
Right.
Yeah. No, you're to your point, you're exactly right. You don't have to spend a lot of money to hustle out there and find a deal. If you beat the streets and you network, you will find deals. There's no doubt about it.
That's it. And you got to be normal. Like, just like people always ask me, what do you say? It's like, I don't know. Like, pretend you're on a date. Be normal. Listen, ask questions, be engaging. If they ask you something, follow up. Like, just do that stuff. And it by and large, if you just do what you say you're going to do and they like you, they're going to bring you stuff.
Yeah, 100%. Well, and to those folks that are listening, I've known Frank for a couple of years. I can vouch the dude knows his stuff. Even in our CG group, I mean, he blows us away with some of his presentations. And he's recently gotten into the education space. And I'll let you talk about that for a second, Frank. If somebody's out there and they need some motivation, they need some coaching, what does that look like if they wanted to work with you?
Sure. We have a couple of ways that we can work together. I have kind of one of those business in a box programs that were really popular several years ago. So we have that. And then the other thing that we have is we actually have an immersion that we train at my office. And it's very small and very intimate, and I teach it. And it's usually between 6 and 9 people. We sit around a conference table, and you're physically in my office. And you'll see deals closing. You'll see us analyzing. You'll talk to our entire staff. And then I have you come to Richmond because I want it to be personal and I want you to be able to see what we do. So we go and look at houses we have under contract, houses that we own that are in the beginning stages of construction, houses that are towards the end, and we go walk something that's already finished. So when you leave, it gives you a real business in a box. Like literally, like we give you the postcards, we give you how to get the mail list, and you can see the entire process. This is absolutely perfect for someone who's done a couple of deals and want to take it to 10 deals, or you've done 8 or 9 deals and you want to get to 20. So it really kind of puts the it puts your business into fast forward.
No, I love it. I don't think there's any better way to learn than to actually be on site in somebody's office, watching them run a successful business rather than just at some seminar where it's all, theoretical. To me, you want to be in it and seeing it in action. So I think that's a very cool offering. How can people reach out to you? How can they find you?
Sure. My name is Frank_CAVA, and then it's at the letter B, the letter E, Cava.com. So Frank_Cava@BEcava.com.
All right, folks, we're going to put this up in the show notes as well. And if you're any interest in talking to Frank, maybe exploring the opportunity, reach out to him at Frank_Cava@BCava.com. Again, we'll put that in the show notes. Frank, thanks so much for coming on the show today. This was fantastic.
It was my pleasure. Good talking to you. Talk to you soon.
All right. See you, buddy. Take care. Hey, folks, it's Ken again, and I want to talk to you for just a quick second about becoming a private lender with our company, Georgia Residential Partners. If you've got money right now sitting on the sidelines, maybe it's in a bank account earning less than 1%, or maybe it's in the stock market and you're worried about where the stock market is headed, you might want to consider becoming a private lender with our company. Where you might be getting 1% to 2% on a CD or a money market account right now, when you become a private lender with us, you're actually well into the double digits in terms of return on investment. Again, if you've got money that's not working for you right now, it's sitting on the sidelines, and you want to get it into investment that's safe, that's passive, and has the opportunity to get you well into the double digits, please reach out to me. You can actually contact us through our website at dealfarm.net. Go to the Contact Us page. It goes right into my inbox, and I will reply and set up a time to talk. Thanks so much for listening to The Deal Farm. We'll see you on the next episode. Take care.